Welcome back. We had lunch. We aired out the room. Welcome to the afternoon portion of our program. 10 heroes, 10 villains. I'm not sure how many of them we have left on the heroes or villains side. Once again, I'm grateful to Yeshivat Or Chaim for enabling us to have the program here in our home of Beit Midrash, as well as to Shai Shamayim for lending us the copies of Tanakh that you see around the room. And for this shiur, the shiur on Micha, he meant well. It is dedicated by Esther and Eliakim Katz in memory of Eliakim's parents, Sarah and Shlomo Katz, Zichronam Livracha. Since some people may have turned on their cell phones during lunch, I will just remind you to please turn them to silent. That would be great, and you can leave them there until 9 o'clock this evening. Okay. As always, as we've said for the other shiurim, we have half an hour. That's not a whole lot of time. I forgot to put on the Facebook Live. I'll do that now. There we go. Three, two, one. Okay. We don't have, a lot of time to cover this story, as, is true for the other stories. Nonetheless, we are going to do the best that we can with it. There are actually quite a few Michas in Tanakh, including someone said to me, isn't Micha a good guy? Why is he with a villain on your flyer? He has a V for villain. And the answer is that this person was thinking about Micha the Navi, the prophet who is in Treasar, which is very different from the Micha who we are going to talk about today. There are a bunch of Michas. Ours appears toward the end of the book of Shoftim. And this story is a bizarre story. This is one of those stories that you look at and think to yourself, I think I'm supposed to laugh, but I'm not really sure. If you take a look at number one, from Professor Yechezkel Kaufman, his book on Shoftim, he writes, my translation here, the author tells his story in an ironic tone. Micha speaks like an idolatrous fetishist. I added in the word irrational because that's his point. Saying, you have taken the God I made, and you'll see what I'm talking about when we get there. Obviously, at this point, we haven't seen that in the story. But he talks about somebody stealing his idol. The Kohen is described as a frivolous careerist, and you'll see that as well. The people of Dun are fist fighters, lawless, and thieving. It's a bizarre story in which it seems like the Jewish people are really held up for ridicule. And that's really what I want to focus on, is what is it that's so funny in this story and that Shmuel sees, Shmuel being credited as the author of Sefer Shoftim, such that he would want to ridicule it here in our book. What is Shmuel trying to highlight for us? So the story takes place in the 17th and 18th chapters of the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, it's page 629. And as I mentioned when we talked about Shimshon and Delilah, this story is potentially out of place in Shoftim. And here's what I mean. Shoftim starts with an introduction to the life of the Jews in the land of Canaan that becomes Israel, get a couple of chapters of introduction, and then it's just story, story after story after story after story, all involving battles between the Jews and the nations around them, and the Jews are led by Shoftim, they're led by judges. And then you get to the last two stories, and they're very different. There are no non-Jews in these stories. The last two stories are internal strife, internal issues among Jews. And they seem to be very different from the other stories, not only in terms of who is involved, but in terms of the tenor of what it's trying to convey, such that the Medrash and Seder Olam, as well as Rashi, as well as Ralbag, as well as many contemporary writers, believe that these two stories at the end, the story of Micha, and then the story of the Pilegesh Megiva, the concubine at Giva, the last two stories in Shoftim, don't actually happen at the end of this book, and likely happened all the way in the beginning of the book. They don't belong at the end. They actually happened in the beginning. Reasons for this timing include the fact that we are told repeatedly in these two stories that there is no Melech b'Yisrael, there is no king in Israel. If you had a shofet, if you had a judge, Then you had somebody who, if not in king in every way, functioned as an authority. So it doesn't make sense to say there is none if you have a show fate. So that's one argument that's brought. Second is chronology. If you take all the years of the judges and put them end to end, then after Shimshon, you seem to be ready for Eli in the beginning of the book of Shmuel. There's no time for these stories to have taken place in the place where they're actually situated. Also, there are certain personalities who show up in these stories which make us think that the stories happened earlier. Someone is going to show up in this story, we'll get to it at the end, but someone is going to show up in this story who is identified in Medrash as the grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, if that's the beginning of Shoftim, that's easy, because the beginning of Shoftim is 28 years after they enter into Israel. If, however, it's the end of Sefer Shoftim, you're now 400 years afterwards. That's a lot harder for it to be Moshe's grandson. Could be great, great, and so on. We'll talk about him a little bit at the end of this shiur. Pinchas is going to be active in this, not in this story, but in the next story, the story of the Pelegish Begivah. Now, it could be, we had a shiur on Pinchas before, it could be Pinchas lived a really long time. There's a pasuk in Divrei HaYamim, which sounds like, you could read it, that Pinchas is active in the time of David HaMelech, of King David. Nonetheless, it's a lot easier if you just say this story happened earlier on. We're also going to see a conquest of land. The tribe of Dan is going to send people to conquer land way up north. The sort of conquest that makes sense if you're in the earlier part of the book of Shoftim, not if you're centuries later at the end. There are two leading commentators who think that this story takes place where it shows up, at the end of Shoftim, right before Shmuel. Radak and Abarbanel. So they're heavyweights. It's not nobody who's saying that. They believe that this actually happens either when Shimshon is held hostage by the Philistines, by the Plishtim, or between Shimshon and Eli. Abarbanel thinks it's when Shimshon is held hostage, because Abarbanel thinks there's no gap. Abarbanel thinks it's Shofate after Shofate after Shofate with no gap in between. So he needs a time when there's no king in Israel, so he says it's when Shimshon's being held hostage. Radak believes that it's between Shimshon and Eli. But let me get to my point here, because I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time on the history question. But within the dominant view that the story of Micha, as well as the concubine of Giva, happened earlier, why are they here at the end? Why are they stuck at the end of the book? If they happened earlier, then that's where you put them in your book. What are they doing here at the end? So there are quite a few reasons, right? Abarbanel makes the point, which I brought you in source number 2 on the sheets. He says it's here because these things are different from the other story. He says if you believe, even he doesn't personally believe that it happened or that happened earlier. But he says, if you believe it happened earlier, the reason and why it will be listed later is because it's different in the sense that there are no enemies. These stories are qualitatively different. That's Abarbanel. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, though, in source number 3, suggests the following. It says that Micha, who we, again, haven't learned anything about yet, we just know that we're going to be seeing him, Micha is going to take in guests. And that's going to be his redeeming feature. The fact that he tries to help travelers. As opposed to the next story, the concubine at Giva, where they harm travelers. But the story of Micha involves Avodah Zarah, it involves idolatry. So what you see here is a story of idolatry, and then a story of hostility to other people and harming other people. And the reason why they're stuck at the end, based on this Gemara, is because they're about a moral decay that the Jews are suffering from. We are told repeatedly, there is no leader at this time. Ein melech b'Yisrael, ish hayashar b'einav yaseh. They all do whatever seems good in their own eyes. And that is why they are together. Because what's going to happen in Shmuel? We're going to get a king. It sets the stage for the introduction of monarchy. Here's what happens when you don't have a leader. Micha is what happens when you don't have a leader. Pelegish Begiva, the story of the concubine, that's what happens when you don't have a leader. These are horror stories. Even if Micha's story is funny, Pilagish Megiva has no humor in it whatsoever. And then you walk into Shmuel and you're ready to say, you know what, give us a king because we got problems. That's basically what we're supposed to see here as the flow. So that's point number one for us, is that the story of Micha is put here at the end to say, things are breaking down, we need stronger leadership. Now, Micha's story I mentioned is going to involve idolatry, and we're going to get into the story in a moment. But what I want to do first is just remove one element from the story, because it's a medrash that I think many people have probably heard, but I don't want to get into it because it'll take us too far afield. So I brought it on your sheet so you can see it in source number 4. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that suggests that the idol that Micha is going to have is actually an idol taken out of Egypt with them. Way back when? When we got out of Mitzrayim, which could be 70 years before the story, or it could be, you know, whatever, a lot more. But the idol is actually from Egypt, and even there's more to the story that Micha is a baby who Moshe had saved in Egypt. But that's beyond the scope of where we're going with this. I mention it, but move on. So let's see the story itself, now that we've had 10 minutes of introduction. Take a look, please, at page 629. This is a bizarre story. I'm going to read through and translate as we go along. You have the English in front of you. There was a man from Mount Ephraim. His name was Michayahu. Don't get caught up between the switch from Michayahu to Micha. That happens in Tanakh for reasons beyond the scope of what we're doing right now. He said to his mother, the 1,100 silver coins that were taken from you, and you cursed whoever had taken it, and you said it in my ear, the money is with me, I took it. And his mother said, my son, you are blessed unto Hashem. If anyone understood that, you're in good shape. I don't know what you're talking about. First of all, note the 1,100 silver coins, right? Like the bribe that was given to Delilah, 1,100 from each of them. It's a real amount of money. You can do a lot with 1,100 silver coins. So, as we'll see. So, his mother has lost 1,100 silver coins. She believes it was stolen. She issues a curse on whoever stole her 1,100 silver coins. And he says to her, I have them. Whether he's saying, I took it, I'm sorry, I was using it for household expenses, or I stole it and now I feel bad, is unclear. Commentators differ on it. But he says, here's the money. And he wants to give it back to her. And she says, you are blessed to Hashem. The name she uses is the name of God. That's important. Vayoshev es elef umea kesef le'imo. He gives her back the 1,100 silver coins. And his mother says, I dedicated the money to God. From my hand to my son to make pesel umasecha, a statue, a molten image. In the same sentence where she talks about Hashem, she uses the name Yud, Hey, Vav, and Hey, a name we associate with only with God. And now, I'm giving the money to you, she says to him. So he says, you take the money, and she says, no, you take the money, and it's actually for God, to make a statue for God. Because that's a good idea. So what does he do in sentence 4? Vayashev es hakesef le'imo. He gave the money back to his mother. This is like hot potato. You take it. His mother takes 200 silver coins out of the 1,100. She pockets the other 900, apparently. She takes 200. She gives it to a smith who makes it into a statue, and it's in Micha's house. Why is it in Micha's house? Look what we find out in sentence 5. Because Micha had a Beit Elohim. I don't know whether I should read that as Beit Elohim or Beit Elohim. He has a house of God, unclear whether that is uppercase G or lowercase G. But now he has statues. And he made an ephod utrafim. Ephod, we think of it as the jacket, right, that that a Kohen can wear. It is associated with religious worship. And then trafim. So trafim are kind of a multi-purpose tool in Tanakh. They show up in different ways in different places. The best explanation I'm going to be able to give in 30 seconds is that trafim were some kind of a human form that were used at times in religious worship, but not exclusively so. Sometimes they were used as a tool to tell the future. Again, it's a longer story. We're not going into Trafim right now, but they can be used as part of Avodah Zarah, as part of idolatry. So Micha has a house of God. He has the jacket. He has the Trafim. And now he has Pesel u'Masecha. He has a statue also. Neat. And then what does he do? He takes one of his kids and he says, you be the Kohen. Not Kohen, descendant of Aaron, but the one who will serve. And we are told, "Bayamim ahem ein melech b'Yisrael." There's no king in Israel. Ish hayashar beinav yaaseh, and everybody just does what they think is right. So there's nobody, as the Radak says, to keep Micha in line. So you have the situation in which the money was missing. His mother said it was stolen. She curses whoever stole it. He says, "Ma, I got it. Here, take it." She says, "You know what? I've dedicated it to God. Go make an idol with it." He says, "No, thanks." She says, "Fine, I'll do it. Here's the idol or statue. I shouldn't say idol, statue." That's our story at this point, but it gets weirder. Sentence 7. There's a kid, a na'ar, a youth. Maybe not a youth. Na'ar is its own vague word. We'll call him a youth. From Beit Lechem in Yehuda, because there are two Beit Lechems, one in Zebulun, one in Yehuda. He is described as being from the family of Yehuda, but he is a Levi. So his mother was from Yehuda. But he himself is a Levi, and he lives there. But he leaves Beit Lechem. He leaves the city from Beit Lechem Yehuda to find another place to live. He's broke, as we'll see. So he needs some place to get supported. See, he comes to Har Ephraim, the region where Micha is. He comes to the house of Micha. And Micha says to him, "Where are you from?" And he says, "I am a Levi from Beit Lechem Yehuda." Suggest the commentators that he says, "I am a Levi," as in, support me, I'm a Levi. That's what he's trying to say. That's why that's his answer to the question of where are you from. He should have said, "I'm from Beit Lechem." He's not a Levi from Beit Lechem. And he says, "I'm looking for a place to live." So Micha says to him, sentence 10, "Shvayim adi, stay with me, and you can be Av and Kohen. You will be a leader, and you'll be a priest. And I will give you 10 silver coins per year, change of clothing, and food." He had 1,100 silver coins to spend. "I'm going to give you 10 silver coins a year." This Levi sells himself cheap. But now Micha has a Levi. But it says, "Vayelech ha-Levi." It says the Levi left. And then, "Vayoel ha-Levi la-Sheves es ha-Ish." And then he decided, "You know what? I think I am going to stay." And he becomes like one of his children. It's a very interesting flow here in terms of this, where he sort of gets upgraded. Now he's like one of his own children. And not only that, he was a Na'ar. Now he's an Av. He was a youth, and now he's a leader. He was an out-of-work Levi, and now he's a Kohen with a salary. He's doing quite nicely for himself. You start to understand why source number one called him a little bit of a careerist here, right? So Micha's thrilled. Sentence 12. Micha gives the Levi his tools, and the Na'ar becomes for him a Kohen, and he's in the house of Micha. And Micha says, sentence 13, "Ataya dati, now I know, ki yetiv Hashem li, God's going to help me, ki haya li a Levi la Kohen, because I got myself a Levi as a Kohen," as though this was a good idea. Right? He thinks that he has actually pleased God with this. Well, that's all the first part of the story. The second part of the story I'm going to do in brief. It doesn't have as much to do with Micha. And that's the next chapter here. It requires a bit of an introduction. The tribe of Dan receives a portion in the west-southwest of Israel. That's where Dan has their land. However, if you were to look in the Torah at Moshe's bracha to Dan, he says of Dan, Yizanek min ha-Bashan, that they spurt out from the Bashan. The Bashan is way up in the north. And so what we're told in Yehoshua, in chapter 19 of Yehoshua, is that they actually took a second piece of land. They went up north, and they took another piece of land at the top of the Yarden. In fact, they're actually, possibly, according to some of the commentators, east of the Yarden, which is fascinating. Why in the world is that fascinating? Reuven, Gad, and Menashe have land east of the Yarden. What do Reuven, Gad, Menashe, and Dan have in common? This is a hard one. What do Reuven, Gad, and Menashe, and Dan have in common? They're firstborns. Reuben is the firstborn of Leah, of Leah. Gad is the firstborn of Zilpah. Manasseh is Yosef's firstborn through, you know, and therefore from Rachel. And Dan is the firstborn of Bilhah. The firstborns get land east of the Yarden. There's more to be said about that. I just wanted to point that out. But Dan gets this land that is way up north. There's a debate as to whether they were actually allowed to do this. Was this part of their portion, they just never conquered it? Or whether this was actually something brand new. Radak in source number 6 reflects that. But they go north, and they say, we are going to take this land way up north, and they do a consult, though. Take a look, please, at sentence 5 in chapter 18, we're on page 631. You see, they come through Har Ephraim. Everybody in Shochem goes through Har Ephraim. It's this big central place where everything happens. So they go through this area, and in sentence 2, we found out they went to Micha's house. They stay in Micha's house, this group from Dan that wants to go do reconnaissance up north, and they're there. They hear this Levi. They recognize that he is a Levi. That's its own story, not for right now. They say to him, what are you doing here? What's your story? And he says, this is what Micha arranged. He hired me and I am a Kohen for him. And so they said to him, Sha'al na Belokim, go ask God and let us find out whether we will succeed on this path. And he says, Lechu l'shalom, go in peace, or go to peace. Nocha Hashem dargachem asher telchuva, the path you will walk is in front of God. Meaning, Hashem approves. And notice again, he uses the name Yud, Hey, Vav, and Hey. He uses the name of Hashem. So they want to consult with Hashem about whether they will succeed. So ask the Trafim, whatever these things are, whether we will succeed or not. And then they go up north. They succeed in their reconnaissance up north. They end up raiding the north. But before they raid the north, look at what happens. Go a little further down the page. What we want is, hang on. Yeah, take a look at sentence 14. That's what we're looking for. The group that went for reconnaissance came back to Dan. They gave the report. Now, Dan has sent an armed force that's going to fight to conquer this land of Laish. So in sentence 14, the 5 men who had been on the reconnaissance group initially said to their brethren, you know, there's a place here that has the statues and the trafim and everything else. You know what to do. So they go there and they know what to do. They come to the house and they say, how are you? And the 600 armed men are standing outside of the house. In sentence 16, the 5 original men come into the house, they take the idol, or the statue, they take the ephod, they take the trafim, and the Kohen is standing there, and they have 600 armed men that are right with them. Right, sentence 17 there, for those who have it open in front of them. So they came in, they took everything, and the Kohen says to them, Ma temosim? What exactly are you guys doing? And they said, Hachareish. They said, be quiet. Sim yadcha picha, put your hand on your mouth. Velechi manu, and go with us. Veheye lanu la'avulu kohen. And you can be a leader and a kohen for us. Hato ve'yosa kohen lebeis ish echad. Ve'yosa kohen l'shevet l'mishpacha b'Yisrael. This is an upgrade. You were in one house. You were the kohen for this one little house of Micha. You could do so much better. Come, take it. You'll be a leader. You'll be a leader of a shevet, of a tribe. Vayitav Levi Kohen. The Kohen says, "You know, that's a good point." And he himself picks up the ephod and the trafim and the statue, and he joins Dan. They turn to leave. They've got their entire camp with them. They get a little distance away from Micha's house, where it's sentence 22, and then Micha's household realizes what's going on, and they come running after them, and they call to Dan, and they say, "What is this?" And he said, and the people say back to them, Malacha kinis akta, what are you making such a fuss about? And he goes, what do you mean? And this is what Kaufman quoted in the beginning. Es elav hayasher asisi lakachtem, you took the God I made. Which is, you know, ludicrous. If it's a God, you didn't make it. And if it's a God, then one can steal it. Right? But he has no self-awareness. He says, you stole the God that I made, and my Kohen, and you left. What do I have left? What do you mean, telling me, Malach, what are you upset about? And they said, listen, Al tashma kocha imanu, don't make your voice heard to us. Pen yifkiu b'chem anashim barei nefesh. We have some people here of bitter spirit, which is a term that's used in the Navi to mean somebody you don't mess with. So, we have some very angry people here. You may have noticed. You're better off if you just go home now. And Micha goes home. And they go on to conquer the land of Dan, the land of Leshem or Laish, depending on which text you read, way up north. That is your story of Micha. And then they build a house of idolatry, and that's the way they live. So here you have, and you understand, I hope, a little bit of why I say that this story invites comedy. It's just bizarre. I don't understand anything that happened and why one did what he did or the other one did what he did. And Shmuel wants to ridicule this point. The Ish Hayashar Be'enav Yaaseh. The idea that people just do whatever appeals to them. And what we get here is the danger of a well-meaning but misguided approach to Judaism. It's seen here and in the concubine at Giva, but we're talking about this story because there are two basic views of what was going on in Micha's house of worship where he invited his lady to come be a Kohen. Rashi and Radak say, Micha starts out righteous. His mother wants to make a house of idolatry. Micha has a shtibel, he has a shul. His mother wants it to be for idolatry. She says, here's the money, go get an idol. He says, I want nothing to do with this. She says, come on. He says, no. She says, I'm going to go get it made, which she does, and then I'm going to donate it to your shul so you can't say no. That's what she says to him. And now you're stuck. And he gets won over, Micha gets won over slowly to this. And that's why Rashi and Radak take this view that actually it's Avodah Zarah, it's idolatry. That's one school of thought. And he descended, well-meaning the whole way, into Avodah Zarah. The other take, Ralbag, the Da Mikra edition of Shoftim, and others say no. This is what we call syncretism. You're blending Judaism with the Canaanite idolatries of the time, coming out with some kind of weird new product, which explains why you have the name of Hashem being invoked. It explains why Micha's mother and Micha himself will say, Hashem is now happy with me because I have an idol. What are you talking about? Hashem isn't happy with idolatry. Yeah, but in their world he is. Because what they've done is they blended. They will invoke the name of Hashem even as they have statues in this sanctuary. That's the way that's the second approach. Two ways to take Micha's temple. Either Avodah Zarah or syncretism. Either way, it is born out of his belief that he is doing what he ought to do. I'm skipping the sources that you see on the sheet in the interest of time, but you can follow up with those sources later. But he goes from a position of reluctance to embracing it. We began with the story of the money. Why did we even begin with the story of the money? It has nothing to do with everything that happens thereafter, but it shows the way that he descends into corruption. Why does he want a Levi? Either because he's idolatrous and he thinks that having a Levi is good for that, or more likely, he's syncretist. He's adopting elements of Judaism and then just changing them for himself. It fits the story of the Levi also. The Levi left first when he was offered the gig. Right? Vayelech, he left. Then Vayoel, then he said, you know what, I'm going to stay. And then he was supported. And then he became the Kohen. People get drawn into things if they don't have proper leadership. What you get out of this is the need for a leadership and the need for anchoring in tradition. And now I come back, our last 2 minutes, with this the identification of this Levi. Because at the very end, in Pasuk Lamed, we are told who this Levi is. We finally get his name. Yehonatan, son of Gershom, son of Menashe. But the Nun, in a properly written scroll, is elevated as though you should really read it as Moshe. We don't have the time to go into the following, but the Gemara in Baba Basra says this was actually Moshe's grandson. Because that's the only Gershom ben Moshe we know. This is actually Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson. There's a lot of evidence to support this, but again, it's not for right now. The reason I bring it is because the Gemara asks, if this is Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson, how does he end up working for Avodah Zarah? And it says, you know why? Because he misunderstood Moshe. Moshe said that one who is in need should choose Avodah Zarah rather than beg for help from others. But not Avodah Zarah idolatry. Avodah Zarah, work which is foreign to him. If you feel like you need something, go take on work that is foreign to you. If you have to bag groceries, you bag groceries. Whatever it is, even if it's not your stature and who you think, how you think of yourself, go do that rather than need the help of others. He misunderstood Moshe's statement. There's another Medrash Mechilta, which I brought you at the end, which takes a different approach, which completely different, which says that Yisro made a deal with Moshe. Yisro said, I'm a seeker. I sought God. I want my grandchildren to seek God. If you're going to marry my daughter Tzipporah, fine. But you have to commit that your firstborn is going to be raised to know all about idolatry as well. And Moshe says, okay. And this is your result. Two different midrashic explanations. Both of them with the same idea. You start out with good intentions, but you end up where you didn't belong. That's the story of Micha. As I said in the title, he meant well, but we learn from here, you all know the lines about roads, the good intentions are just not good enough. You need to anchor yourself in tradition, and in this case, have leadership, as the story is placed right before the introduction of the Malchus of the monarchy. I now cede to Ava, you're next, right? For the 2:30 shiur. Thank you very much.